One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
The eyes of that species of extinct giants, whose bones fill the mounds of America, have gazed on Niagara as ours do now. Beneath the thundering majesty of Niagara Falls lies a story whispered through the ages. One that's so eternal that it seems to drown out the very noise of the world. His tall frame is still, silhouetted against the mist, his hat held in one hand, his other resting lightly on the wooden railing. He gazes out, not just at the cascading water, but at something beyond it. Something ancient and unknowable. His brow furrows, and for a fleeting moment, a wistful smile tugs at the corner of his mouth. Giants, he whispers under his breath, the word barely audible, as if speaking it aloud might disturb the ghost of the past. Giants. His mind wanders to the tales that he's read. The curious reports from distant towns, earth cracked open to reveal bones of impossible size, skulls that seem to belong to a race of men forgotten by history. He wonders if they stood here, right here, on this precipice, staring into the same unyielding torrent, their footprints now long erased by time. This place now, a spectacle for tourists. A chill dances up his spine and he draws his coat tighter around him. They were real, these giants. He feels the weight of history pressing against his chest, the stories of those who came before merging with the unending flow of the falls. He breathes in and murmurs to himself, here they stood. The words were carried by the wind. His thoughts are not just of bones and mounds, but of the vastness of time itself, of how small and fleeting a man's life is against the backdrop of eternity. The falls remind him of this truth, their ceaseless roar echoing the passage of all things, giants, men, nations, all swept away like so many drops of water into the endless current, and then he stops. And he says to himself, I must put this in a speech. Curious that Abraham Lincoln chose to mention giants. This cryptic phrase has ignited a storm of speculation, linking Abraham Lincoln to the shadowy tales of massive skeletons reportedly unearthed from Native American burial mounds across the United States during the 19th century. So was Lincoln speaking in metaphor, honoring the memory of the ancient peoples who were not giants, but once thrived upon this land? Or could he have been swayed by the sensational reports of his era that the Smithsonian desperately tried to snuff out? These accounts of towering skeletal remains that fueled both fascination and fear. Though many dismissed these discoveries as exaggerated or outright fabrications, they remain a cornerstone of fringe archaeology and the endless intrigue of conspiracy lore. The Nephilim have survived. So where are they today? One of the big questions I get, and indeed many of us ask, is where are the Nephilim today? If they are returning, from where and when? And if they survived the flood, which was supposed to kill everything except two of every animal in Noah's family, right? How are they going to pose a threat to us in the near future? Are there still giants alive today? It's the most accepted idea that these Nephilim are simply giant humans, right? That's what a lot of people believe. They're just giants, but there's more to them. They are partially spiritual entities. So when you ask the question, where are they? Why don't we ever see them? Also ask yourself why people have been recording giants in myths, fables, legends, oral histories, written histories, stories of all types for basically the entire existence of mankind. So we do see them. They're just not where we expect to see them. And you say things like, we would have found them by now if they were out in the woods, or if they were hiding among us or in the caves, somebody would have happened upon one. Also, there's cameras everywhere. Ladies and gentlemen, I direct you to the invasion of Miami by the 7 to 10 foot tall alien creatures. Kind of wild, but there's a running theory that these types of things may be the disembodied spirits of Nephilim, also sometimes called demons. We all remember that in this particular situation, we were provided with almost zero footage whatsoever in Miami, at a mall, a place you would expect to be littered with cameras. But this took place around hundreds of thousands of people at a mall in a very populated city where surveillance, especially commercial security surveillance, would have been widespread. Cell phones everywhere, and yet no footage except this one accidental shot of something we are told is a light infraction or a mispresentation of the size of a normal man due to technical limitations of the camera, because it was on a helicopter. So they say, yeah, sometimes that happens, it's a play of the light. Okay. So, even in an area where there are cameras, for some reason, we can't really seem to capture them. That's kind of weird, right? Combine that with the fact that we don't have any really good, not really good, let's be honest, like not as good as like Thanksgiving photos with the fam bam, like good photos of pretty much any cryptid, to be honest. Which makes you really wonder, do they have an aversion to being photographed? Is it very, very hard to get pictures of them because there's something about them that can't have a picture taken of it? It would later be declared that the whole thing was just a few teens who got in a fight with sticks. I remember being absolutely blown away because there were like hundreds of cops on the scene. The whole thing was shut down. It was making national news and then global news. And then they basically just come out and say, hey, everybody, don't worry. It's just some teenagers with sticks and one of them beat another one of them up, but we're all good. No giants here. And then the police released like a special police statement mocking us. Right? So when you say, where are they? Why haven't we found them? Bro, we've been finding them for thousands of years. You gotta let yourself believe it, though. Finding it is half the battle. Believing what you found is totally different. And as somebody who has seen some things I can't explain with my own eyes, I must tell you that seeing and believing are far different things. So you have to allow yourself to believe that what you're seeing is a Nephilim, because it might be. And within the last like 150 years, they mysteriously decided that the giants were not gonna matter. The mysterious they who do the things that they do and subject us to the things that they choose, the all-powerful they decided that giants weren't going to be part of this narrative. This is a recurring theme that we've been discussing on this podcast, and that obviously, as you can tell, this is a part one. We're going to be going into much deeper. Where are the Nephilim? From whence do they come when they do? And where have they been? And why? We're going to hunt these suckers down. And this is just an introductory episode to that. This is going to get crazy, guys. We're going to give this a proper look. So I pulled some incredible research from online, from an account where it was kind of a bizarre situation. An individual appeared to go completely insane after writing this document because they wrote it, and then I go and examine their profile, and it's just like, if you think talking about giants and Nephilim is crazy nonsense, then the other stuff this guy was talking about was even crazier nonsense. So, you know, I don't know what happened after writing this document. I don't know what drove him to write this document, but he did an incredible write-up on the Nephilim. And then he just vanished completely about 5 years ago. So, why is the Nephilim hidden from modern-day archaeology and history? This was his question. This is what he made one of his final statements about. The Nephilim, for those who don't know, were the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men before the flood, according to Genesis 6:1-4. And when people began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God, the fallen angels, as they will become after this, saw that these women were absolutely beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, and they chose them. They had their way. They had their pick. And then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not abide in mortals forever, for they are flesh. Their days shall be 120 years. Pretty crazy. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God went into the daughters of humans who bore children to them. These were the heroes that were of old, warriors of renown. They were the mighty men." The story of the Nephilim is further elaborated in the book of Enoch, the Greek, Aramaic, and Mengeez manuscripts of First Enoch and Jubilees, obtained in the 19th century and held in the British Museum and Vatican Library, connect the origin of the Nephilim with the fallen angels, and in particular with the Watchers. Samyaza, an angel of high rank, is described as leading a rebel sect of angels in a descent to earth to have sex with the human females. Samyaza, horny as ever, said, "Let's get the gang together. There's some hotties on the block that God just put together. Let's go check them out." And it came to pass that when the children of men had multiplied, that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters. Enoch talks a little about it and says, "And it came to pass that when the children of men had multiplied, that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters. And the angels, the children of the heaven, saw and lusted after them, and said to one another, 'Come, let us choose us wives from among the children of men, and beget us children.' And horny Samyaza, who was their leader, said unto them, 'I fear ye will not indeed agree to this deed, and I alone shall have to pay the penalty of a great sin.'" Because this type of horniness was forbidden. These angels were not supposed to be touching on these human women. So they all swore together, and they bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it, and they were in all 200 who descended in the days of Jared on the summit of Mount Hermon, and called it Mount Hermon in those days, because they had sworn and bound themselves upon it. The Book of Giants is an antediluvian or pre-flood narrative. The earliest known traditions of the book originate in Aramaic copies of a Book of Giants in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Furthermore, references are found in Genesis 6:1 through 4, 1 Enoch, and visions in Daniel 7:9 through 14. This book tells of the background and fate of these Nephilim in the flood. The Book of Giants consists of a group of Aramaic fragments. Because of the fragmentation of the Book of Giants, it is difficult to know the order of the content. But the work is related to the First Enoch analog, which tells a story of the giants that is far more elaborate. Further, the Qumran Book of Giants bore resemblance to another Book of Giants, a different version that followed after it. So, because this stuff evolves, right? It just does, unfortunately, and a lot of stuff does get messed up. That's why you have to constantly be looking for new sources. You have to constantly be questioning what you have. You have to constantly be efficiently vetting your information and relearning stuff. Because just because it happens to snake through into Christianity does not mean that it's necessarily true. The Book of Giants is an expansive narrative of the biblical story of the birth of giants as outlined in Genesis 6:1-4. And in this story, the giants came into being when the sons of God had sex with mortal women who birthed a hybrid race of giants. All right, we talked a lot about hybrids in the last episode, and we've talked about hybrids probably more than anything on this podcast. These giants partook in destructive and immoral actions. They wreaked havoc upon us, and it devastated humanity. So when Enoch heard of this, he was distressed, and he asked God to bring judgment to the giants. And in his mercy, God chose to give the giants a chance to repent by transmitting dreams to two giants named Oya and Haya, who relayed the dreams to an assembly of giants. And the giants were perplexed with the dreams, so they sent another giant named Mahoe to Enoch's house. And Enoch interceded on their behalf and gave tablets to the giants with the meaning of the dreams and God's future judgment. So when the giants heard this, many chose to act in defiance to God. While the Qumran fragments were incomplete at this point, other fragments from parts that came later tell of the host of God subduing the race of giants at this time through battle. And, you know, whether that is true or not, because again, some people do not subscribe to Enoch, and I'm not here to convince you to do one thing or the other, because I don't know myself. There's just no way to really know what's true and what's not a lot of the time. That's why so much of this is faith-based, but I firmly believe that there have been many, many battles and wars fought by heavenly beings and Nephilim and fallen angels and good angels and Nephilim and other things, whatever those other things may be, sometimes man, and we're not always privy to the fact that this is happening, but there is a war raging at any given time, and it probably often results in the physical deaths of these Nephilim. But the giants began to devour the works of men and went on to kill and consume them. They became cannibalistic, and this might remind you of tales like the giants of Lovelock Cave, the red-haired ones who were eating everybody around them. And, you know, these types of beings also sinned against the birds and the beasts of the sky and the creeping things and the fish of the sea. It also mentions that giants devoured the flesh of one another and drank each other's own blood. Like, these beings were not good beings. And so that's why we always have to be really careful and ask ourselves, is this something that would be redeemed, or is this an abomination? This act of drinking blood would have horrified the people, and we know God hates the drinking of blood. And there is further evidence of this in Leviticus 17:10 through 16. And in this passage, there are strict rules regarding the blood of the animal. It says, I will set my face against any Israelite or any foreigner residing among them who eats blood, and I will cut him off from the people, for the life of the creature is in the blood. Boom. The text relates how some giants, some sons of the fallen angels, have some dreams that foresee the biblical flood, you know, And there's a brief mention of one of those giants, this Oya, who is found in the Babylonian Talmud, where it is said Sihon and Og from the Book of Numbers were brothers, as they were the sons of Ohiah, the son of Samhazai, one of the leaders of the fallen angels in the Book of Enoch. So we see an alleged sort of correlation there. And the version found at Qumran also describes the Sumerian hero Gilgamesh and the monster Humbaba. So there's a lot of stuff that sort of ties it together that really makes our ancient world look and sound like Lord of the Rings. But I mean, this is ancient text, right? Like, so when the Greeks talk about it, I automatically think, what did the Greeks see? When the Romans and the Greeks and the, you know, the Sumerians and the Egyptians and the Native Americans, the Aztecs, when all of these people all over the world talk about their giants in these ancient texts, we've got to pay attention to that, because even though it sounds like Lord of the Rings, there's something going on. Like this, like I'm not sitting here trying to, you know, like make this up. This has been being made up for thousands of years. And I think we've got to ask ourselves why. There's also this huge push right now to believe in nothing, to force ourselves to say that everything that we're seeing in the sky is nothing or nothing to be worried about, when in actuality, it might be pretty much something to be worried about. Whatever's going on out here, this might be Nephilim activity. Let's talk about the Anunnaki a little bit. In his 1976 book, The 12th Planet, Russian-American author Zechariah Sitchin claimed that the Anunnaki were actually a race of extraterrestrial beings from the undiscovered planet Nibiru, who came to Earth around 500,000 years ago in order to mine gold. According to Sitchin, the Anunnaki genetically engineered Homo erectus to create modern humans and to work as their slaves. Sitchin claimed that the Anunnaki were forced to leave Earth when Antarctic glaciers melted, which caused the flood of Noah, which also destroyed the Anunnaki's bases on Earth. And these had to be rebuilt, and the Nephilim, needing more humans to help in this massive effort, then in exchange taught them agriculture. So, for their survival, I guess. And they would also then feed the Nephilim and do all that kind of stuff. Ronald Fritz writes that, according to Sitchin, the Anunnaki built the pyramids and all the other monumental structures from around the world that ancient astronaut theorists consider so impossible to build without highly advanced technologies. Sitchin also claimed that the Anunnaki had left behind human-alien hybrids, some of whom may still be alive today, unaware of their alien ancestry. And this goes along with what we've been saying about the NPCs. Sitchin is a little bit more fantasy than truth, in my opinion. He's a little bit delulu. There's a lot going on in this book. I don't know if you guys have read it, but it's pretty crazy. The 12th Planet. So we know that it wasn't all that. They're probably not on Nibiru. There really may have been a great battle, you know, and that's why we talk so much about the rings of Saturn in that context, a great space battle that took place that resulted in a planet being absolutely obliterated. I'm not saying that whole idea doesn't align with anything that I believe. I'm just saying that I don't think everything in Sitchin's book, which is not, you know, which is a science fiction, by the way, I don't think it's all quite on the dot. I think that these things are genetically modified human angel hybrids, not aliens. Let's gloss over some modern day Nephilim conspiracy theories and some of these things that kind of point to them still being around, or being around in recent history, or just having existed at all. All of these things are mind-blowing realizations if you allow yourself to accept them. So we've got the giant skeletons that have been being unearthed from ancient burial mounds across America forever. And now they just stop telling us about it, but they also make it illegal to dig up burial mounds, which of course is probably right. We don't want anybody going and grave robbing, right? But it's very convenient that they're not even being really studied anymore. And that's because they can't stop finding giant bones in them. And you can find hundreds of documents about this. Like, it's common knowledge that they were digging up giants everywhere in the world. And there's even crazier stuff in other countries a lot of the times too. But there have been, and I think that's mainly because they're not as quickly to dismiss it. But for some reason in America, in the United States, giants aren't allowed to exist. We don't believe in those here. Even though our grounds are filled with the corpses of giants. Furthermore, the Smithsonian kind of half admits to the destruction of thousands of giant human skeletons in the early 1900s. And we know that they were paying farmers and grave robbers to dig them up and destroy them or turn them in. There's also that crazy story about the U.S. soldiers who claim to have shot and killed a 12 to 15 foot giant in Afghanistan. You guys may have heard that story, the Kandahar giant. So where are the giants? Well, there's some of them running around in the Middle East still. Giant skeletons have been uncovered in Saudi Arabia as well. There was a graveyard of giants found in China. There have been giant human skulls with horns allegedly discovered in North America. There have been gigantic giants found in Australia, at least the remnants of them. And Bulgaria, all over the world, we find these giants. There was even a giant found in an official archaeological dig by the Iranians. We've got giant skeletons coming out of Greece. We have a 38 centimeter long finger found in Egypt. Right? We have elongated skulls and double rows of teeth. We have six fingered pictographs. We have 13 crystal skulls that have been found. And don't even get me started on the rumors of the ones that are being imprisoned in Antarctica. But today we're going to talk a little bit more about the Kandahar Giant. And I already mentioned this one in another episode, and a lot of people have talked about the Kandahar Giant. It's a very, very popular story. But for those who haven't heard it, rather than the old skeletons, because I am interested in the old skeletons, of course, but I'm also interested in knowing where they are right now, knowing where the live ones are. Are they in the earth? Are they in the oceans? Are they, where exactly are they hiding, right? The Kandahar Giant conspiracy theory is cool because it's about U.S. soldiers fighting and taking a 12 foot to 15 foot fair skinned red haired giant with six fingers and six toes in Afghanistan. Soldiers at the base began to hear rumors of a man being killed that was three times the height of an ordinary human. Paranormal researcher L.A. Marzulli corroborated the account with two soldiers, and Afghan locals told stories of cannibalistic giants living in nearby caves. Stories of these giants in the Middle East are widespread among the people there. George Norrie interviewed the helicopter pilot that transported the Kandahar Giant on Coast to Coast Radio, and the pilot said that it was a dead guy, about 9 to 12 feet, laying in a fetal position on the pallet. He was around an 1,100-pound guy. The pilot went on to corroborate that the giant was fair-skinned, red-haired, and had extra digits on his hands and feet. In 2002, a U.S. patrol had gone missing in a very remote area of Afghanistan. Another patrol was dispatched on a search and rescue mission, and one soldier on that patrol described what he saw after coming around the side of a mountain. As we bent around this corner, you could see the opening of the cave, and then I see a lot of rocks, which is another oddity, and then bone matter. I'm not close enough to identify what kind of bones, but I did see what I knew to be a piece of our communication equipment. So instantly, we're thinking ambush. Maybe animal, you know, could be anything. There was enough room in front of the cave, but it had a sheer drop-off. but there was enough room that we got into a decent dispersal in case of ambush. Not long after they had gotten into that dispersal formation, they saw something emerge from the cave that, despite their preparation, caught them fully off guard because it was a man, at least 12 to 15 feet in height. This is a monster. Red beard, with his hair longish past his shoulders, and it's a scarlet red. And his buddy Dan runs at him and starts shooting, which broke all of us, he says, into the reality, because it was surreal. While Dan is moving at him, another bro of mine is laying down fire, and I start firing. He skewers Dan. He's now got him on his pike. It went through him. He's got him, and he's coming after more. Eventually, the giant was killed, but Dan had also been killed. And the patrol unit was soon visited by a helicopter that dropped some cargo netting. They were told they had to bundle up the giant in the netting, and soon after they were done, a larger helicopter came by, dropped a hook, and the giant was carried off. The soldier confirmed that the red-haired, fair-skinned giant had six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot, which is a characteristic of the Nephilim. After they had submitted their after-action report, the soldier recounts that they were told by their top brass to rewrite it in a particular fashion, presumably to remove any mention of a giant being. Although not an eyewitness, another special ops soldier in Afghanistan provides the following corroborating testimony. However, we would come back to the base and started hearing this rumor about a unit that killed this, what they started calling this really tall person. At first, I didn't think anything of it. Then come to find out that the person they killed was actually three times the size of a man, had extra digits on their hands and extra digits on their feet, and had red hair, and a special unit had come in and wanted this target. Well, we'd heard that they killed this thing inside a cave or the mouth of a cave, and there was common knowledge among the military to hear this. When you first hear, you're thinking, like, this has got to be a joke. This has got to be a hoax. Then, after things go down a certain way and you keep hearing it, you start to realize it's not a joke. They kept telling us to keep our weapons high, which normally means it's two to the chest, one to the head. But they kept telling us to point it towards a man's head and then put it higher. So we would question, why would they want us to shoot higher than a man's head? And this story has been told many, many times. And like some of these ancient texts, it has also changed over time. There's parts of it that have been added, parts of it that have been omitted. But it is one of those stories that I generally accept the majority of what's being told to me as possible truth. In the Catholic Church, the worship of the sun seems to hide in plain sight, right? The roots of this deception stretch back to the Roman Empire, where tricking the masses into sun worship really began. If you look closely, you'll notice the sun symbols in Catholic imagery bear striking resemblances to ancient Egyptian drawings. Take a closer look at those depictions of ancient gods sitting on thrones, towering over the smaller figures at their feet. Are those figures merely peasants, or is this a nod to giants of old? And the bigger question, do fallen angels worship the sun? The sun is often associated with the morning star, a term that the Bible uses for both Jesus and Lucifer. So when the imagery points to the morning star, it makes you wonder who or what is being referred to. Speaking of ancient Egypt, did you know that the name Satan has Egyptian origins? And wouldn't you know it, the Library of Alexandria, which held countless Egyptian artifacts and texts, was burned to the ground. So, do you think this was an accident? Or was something, perhaps a history of Satan himself, being deliberately erased? And I know there's the Library of Alexandria itself is a great conspiracy theory, so who really knows what happened to that? But the Vatican was founded in 400 AD, and it holds its own secrets. Reports suggest that giant bones were found in its basement. Giant bones. In the heart of one of the most influential religious institutions in history. This would make a lot of sense to me, The Catholics love to collect relics of all types, both secular and Christian. They would most certainly be interested in maintaining a collection of such artifacts as Nephilim bones and body parts, as these are the descendants of some of the false gods that they worship in secret and sacrifice children to, and all hail while they do their little finger parties. And they aren't the only ones connected to this mystery either. Enter the Smithsonian. This renowned institution has been accused of covering up evidence of giants for hundreds of years, even admitting to the destruction of thousands of giant skeletons. Skeptical? Consider the fact that the Smithsonian wasn't just interested in giants. According to records, the Smithsonian CEO left funds in his will to sponsor an expedition to the Hollow Earth to collect plant life for the museum. Allegedly, and curiously, this expedition was never completed, so why not? Why not? There's some crazy stuff with the Smithsonian. They're clearly the narrative crafters of our life. They decide our history. They decide our history books. They make sure it gets done. They are one of the most powerful institutions in America, even if they don't appear to be, simply because they are part of this propaganda machine that is meant to purposely sway you away from knowing the truth. The story doesn't end there, though. Could world governments be hiding evidence of a hollow earth to conceal the existence of giants and hybrids? If the giants were the offspring of women and fallen angels, could they still exist beneath our very feet? What about the strange account of Admiral Byrd's Antarctic expedition, which allegedly encountered advanced beings? And they just kind of like swept that under the rug too. Are they descendants of these hybrids? An army of the Antichrist waiting to rise during the Battle of Armageddon? Are they the reason that men will scream for death but not find that sweet relief? And what of Antarctica? Could the frozen continent conceal entrances to the underworld? Probably, most likely. Some speculate that NASA was created to focus our eyes on the stars and away from what lies beneath us. What might we find if we looked downward instead of upward? It's clear that history as we know it may not be the truth at all. The elites have rewritten it, shaping it to serve their purpose. Religion has often been wielded as a tool of control, a way to keep the masses compliant. And that's why I don't follow organized religion. Instead, I place my faith in God, the Son Jesus, and the Holy Spirit. It's the Holy Spirit that guides us toward the real truth, the truth that lies hidden beneath all of these layers of deception. So keep searching, keep questioning, and always look beyond what you've been told, because the answers might be closer than you think. And if you look, sometimes you can find encounters online of people who genuinely believe that they've had encounters with Nephilim in the current modern age, in their pure Nephilim form. Not in demon spirit or Bigfoot costume. This next story comes from one such person. It was the spring of 2007. My then boyfriend and I were on our way from New York down to Miami to go to a music festival. We were driving south on the highway along the east coast of Central Florida when we pulled into a rest area so that he could catch a nap. He had been driving all day when he decided that he desperately needed a short rest before getting back behind the wheel. We had very recently bought the van, and he did not think that I could handle maneuvering it, so he was doing all the driving. But I later proved him wrong. He parked and jumped in the back of the van and laid down on the futon mattress that we had laid there. He told me to leave him alone and then proceeded to pass out from exhaustion. I was pretty freaked out because the rest area building was unmanned, locked up, and dark inside. The restrooms were closed. The small rest area building was surrounded by dark woods. There were about four other cars in the small parking lot, but no sign of any drivers, so I imagine they were having an emergency laydown as well. Normally, I would never have set foot outside of the van alone in such a scenario. My instincts told me not to get out of the van, but I had taken some Midol for my menstrual cramps, and they had given me brutal nausea. I needed some pretzels. I mustered up all of my courage, and I opened up the passenger side door and squeezed through the space between our vehicle and the vehicle that was parked directly next to ours. And as soon as I had a clear line of sight to the front of the rest stop building, I saw the thing. I saw it, clearly. Straight ahead, I saw the brightly lit front facade of the rest stop. And to the left of the doors was it. To the right of the doors was a vending machine. Immediately, it communicated with me. I was flooded with what I consider a telepathic message from this being. I cannot be seen. I cannot be seen. I must travel by night and exist in darkness. I cannot be seen. I cannot be seen. I cannot be seen. And I felt an enormous wave of compassion for the being rather than fear, which may seem a more logical reaction to someone hearing this story. For some reason, my brain only categorized it as one thing initially, an outsider worthy of compassion and tolerance. Its skin was pure chalk white, not the skin tone white like Caucasians, but the color white. Its eyes were several times larger than ours. It had two little air holes for a nose and very thin mouth. Its frame was completely concealed by its enormous, long, black hooded robe. It looked as though it was quite gaunt underneath, pretty frail looking. It was sitting on its bottom, knees bent, back against the brick front of the rest area. To the left of the front doors of the rest area, it was sitting with its back, very straight, tall, and erect. It seemed in awe of me, or maybe in awe that I was actually approaching it. It looked vaguely like a human, very vaguely. Its face was snake-like. Its eyes were right on me. I threw a little everyday smile in its direction, and then I did something strange. I continued to walk toward the rest area even after seeing it. I walked towards the rest area building, closer to it. I walked forward about 20 feet from the rear of the van to the rest area steps, up the 20 or so steps and to the right where the vending machine was located. My thoughts at this point were very bizarre in retrospect. I felt bad for the thing. I didn't want it to feel different. I know that sounds hilariously quaint, if we are indeed talking about an interdimensional being, but I didn't want to run back into the van because I didn't want to hurt its feelings. I didn't want to make it feel like a freak. It had already told me that it could not be seen due to the way that people would react, so I wanted to know that I didn't judge it for the way it looked, and that I was willing to come to terms with its horrific appearance in order to extend some humanity to it. I did not know about fallen angels and such at the time. So, it was with that very bizarrely strong conviction to be righteous and humane to it that I walked toward the vending machine. I actually got pretzels. I'm telling you, my stomach was churning. I used the vending machine with my back to it. Snyder's pretzels in hands, I swiveled around to look at it again before descending back down the steps. It was at that moment that pure terror rippled through me. I was closer to it now, approximately 15 feet away, and I could see now that there was definitely no way that it was human. It was staring right at me like a wide-eyed insect. It was still in exactly the same position, except for that it had turned its head to look at me better as my position changed. It looked like an alien. It looked like a demon. It was not human. Its huge, one-dimensional eyes, were they totally black? I'm not sure, but I know that it did not have white in its eyes. They were almond-shaped, like the classic alien eye that we all know. It was then that I realized that it was extremely freaking tall. unthinkably tall. Although I was standing and it was sitting, its head still stood taller than mine. Its huge eyes were fixed on me totally, with fascination, alarm, and with the most intense focus. Just like the way my cat looks at something right before she pounces on it. When I had made the decision to climb the stairs toward it and not to retreat to the van, I thought that it was sitting on top of something and that that was why its head was raised up so high. Now, from this closer perspective, I could see that it was not sitting on anything but its own butt. And if I had realized that it was this freaking tall at the start, I very well may not have gone up the stairs. So, after the ripple of terror went through me, I responded by smiling the way you smile at a stranger when your eyes catch on the bus. I shot at a casual, thin, innocuous little, hey, how you doing smile. Why and how I acted as if things were totally freaking normal, I cannot explain. I have never acted so cool in my life. There's a Seinfeld episode when Elaine says that one of the reasons that she's a decent person is because when I see freaks in the street, I never ever stare at them, and yet I'm careful not to look away, see, because I want to make the freaks feel comfortable. So that's exactly what was going through my head, believe it or not. If I were to guess what the thing was doing when I encountered it, judging by its body language, I would say that it was somewhat displaced and resting. But I have no clue. Maybe it was in the middle of something far more sinister. It did not look like a mutant or an experiment. It looked ancient, timeless, placeless, but also graceful, and yet horrible. It was also firmly in this dimension when I saw it. It was not a hazy vision in the slightest. The lighting was not dim. It was not even a remotely ethereal experience. The extremely bright lights that illuminated the front facade of the rest area building revealed every contour of this entity. If only I had been closer, I could have provided much more detail about its facial features. As I was walking back to the van, I quickly strategized about how to make sure that my fear did not paralyze me and prohibit me from getting safely inside the car. I decided not to look back or even around me as I turned the key, because if I saw that it had moved or if I saw it coming towards me, I would have been too terrified to manage with the car keys. I got in the van and I locked the door. I screamed that we needed to leave immediately, and we did. As we drove away, about 90 seconds after it was my last sight, I looked out the window and saw that it was gone. There was nothing where it had been, just brick wall and concrete floor. She goes on to say that it plagued her for many months after, returning to her time and time again in her mind, telepathically. It does make you wonder how much of these mind diseases that go around these days are due deep down to Nephilim interference. And then we've got this whole alien thing going on. The disclosure that is already losing traction, by the way. Kind of weird how that happens. It's just like now nobody even cares. They told us that there's aliens, and then they invaded us with aliens, and then now we're just totally desensitized to it. All of us. Just like that. That's all it took. Right? Some of that stuff is absolutely insane, too. You know, when you think about the New Jersey drones and the weird orbs, especially the ones that appear to be destroying other orbs, and the ones that come out of the ocean, those are pretty creepy. I don't believe these beings are extraterrestrial. Instead, I think they are part of something far more sinister, something rooted in humanity's oldest struggles. From the beginning, Satan has been tampering with DNA and genetics, creating hybrids like the Nephilim. These so-called grays, the tall whites, the reptilians, they're not visitors from other planets, guys. They're creations of his genetic experiments, because he cannot create something out of nothing, so he must manipulate. They must manipulate. And that's exactly what they do. And they create these Nephilim and other hybrids that are similar. Bigfoot, Dogman. The reptilians, you know, the greys, whatever this lady saw, like wraiths. I mean, that sounds like a wraith to me, but I've never heard of wraith communicating with humans. So my point is, these monsters that we never see, they're not on our team. Like, it doesn't appear to me that God needs monsters on his team. Things that horrify us, things that scare us in not a good way, right? They're all genetic hybrids. They're crafted for a purpose that is far beyond mere curiosity. There's something else going on here. Satan's ultimate goal is to unite humanity under a single banner to wage war against Yeshua when he returns. How would he accomplish such a monumental task? The answer is deceptively brilliant. First, his aliens would arrive. Aliens claiming to be humanity's true creators, and they would position themselves as our saviors, warning us that an enemy, Yeshua, will soon come to destroy us. The aliens are coming, the bad ones, right? In this narrative, we are not the redeemed, but the oppressed, needing to stand and fight. This is the great deception foretold in scripture. In Matthew 24, 4 through 5, Yeshua warned us clearly, "Don't let anyone mislead you. You will come into contact with many who will claim to come in my name, and they will say, 'I am the Messiah,' and they will deceive many." Luke 21, 11 adds even more chilling detail. "There will be great earthquakes, and there will be famines and plagues in many lands, and there will be fearful things and great miraculous signs from heaven." But when I studied the Greek, something fascinating emerged. The phrase "great miraculous signs from heaven" can also be interpreted as "from the sky," obviously. Could this be a reference to UFOs and the term "fearful things," translated from the Greek phobotron, is even more revealing. Phobotron is derived from phobos, meaning fear, but it is used uniquely in this context. It doesn't appear anywhere else in the New Testament. In ancient Greek mythology, phobotron was a term used to describe monsters. When Yeshua spoke of these fearful things, was he referring to monsters? As I've been saying since I started this podcast, we are approaching a time where each and every single one of us are going to be experiencing cryptids in ways that we never thought was possible, because we never thought these things were real the way that we're about to know that they're real. Right? And if so, could these monsters align with what we think of today as aliens? Or gods, or demigods? The connections are undeniable, especially as UFO and alien sightings continue to escalate. Could this be preparation for what is to come? Then consider this. The final 7-year cycle begins, hopefully, on October 2nd of this year. If they don't make their grand entrance then, it may happen at the midpoint of the cycle, in the spring of 2028. Either way, the timeline feels disturbingly close. The timeline for that eventually ends in our redemption, but first we must go through some great tribulations. First, we're gonna get real messed up. There's gonna be horrors to behold. We are going to be subject to nightmares beyond our imagination. And it'll end with us being redeemed, but don't think that you don't have to go through it too. You're not going to be spared from everything. Remember that your faith is only faith if it's challenged. Anybody can believe in something that they know is never going to happen, or that they're not willing to die for, that isn't tested. You will be tested. But let's take a look back at history. In 1937, Jack Parsons, an occultist who's deeply involved in esoteric practices, founded the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Within a decade, his team developed prototype craft, one of which famously crashed in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. And since then, the leaps in technology have been absolutely extraordinary. How much of this progress is natural? And how much is influenced by something darker? Combine this with the shadowy whispers of Project Bluebeam, if true, This would stage a global scale alien invasion, using advanced tech and psychological manipulation to unite humanity under a single false narrative that aliens are real and we either must stand against them together or stand with them together. What better way to control billions of people than by presenting a common enemy from the stars? Or a master god race ally, as they will appear. The stage is being set, people. The signs are all around us. They're not hard to see. The pieces of the puzzle are coming together, and they point to a great impending deception. So, just be ever vigilant out there, guys. It's a crazy world. This has been part one. I'm excited to dive down into some of this and hunt down some Nephilim with you guys. Remember, give us a follow. Give us a like. I appreciate all of your support. Don't drink the water and question everything. Later.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.